Let me begin by welcoming all of you and thanking you for joining us this afternoon for this rare opportunity to spend an extended period of time with Dr. Joseph Wu, Chairman of the Mainland Affairs Council in Taiwan. I know that Joseph is familiar to many of you in this room. He is a frequent visitor to Washington and a welcome one, coming here to convey the views of his government and the people of Taiwan to all of us here in Washington concerned about issues of U.S.-Taiwan relations and cross-strait relations in particular. As you know, prior to serving as chairman of the Mainland Affairs Council, Joseph was deputy secretary in the president's office in Taiwan, which is all to say that he probably stands alone in Taiwan today as really the most knowledgeable insider on developments in cross-strait relations and what it means for the political scene in Taipei today. So we're very, very fortunate to have this opportunity to speak with him. There are a lot of interesting issues and developments in recent weeks and months I hope Joseph will be addressing. I'm sure he will. Some positive, some negative. We've heard some interesting developments, for example, in possible new openings in cross-strait relations related to questions of repatriation of criminals, on questions of opening tourist links, possibilities of expanding flights during holiday seasons across the straits. These are all positive, but this obviously happens in the broader context of continuing tensions across the strait, the continuing insistence on the part of mainland China to, if necessary, use force to bring about the reunification of Taiwan, and, of course, to back that kind of rhetoric up with a continuing, steady military modernization effort demonstrated most obviously by the missile buildup opposite of Taiwan. Here in Washington, Joseph, you probably know that there's been a great deal of concern in just the past month or so about China's anti-satellite weapons test and what that might mean as a warning, perhaps, from Beijing about its intentions vis-a-vis the American military presence in the region, and possibly what it might mean about its intentions with regard to Taiwan. So it's an interesting time that you're here. We're very glad that you can join us. Joseph said that he would speak for about 20 minutes and hopefully leave us ample opportunity for a good discussion following that. You can see, Joseph, by the turnout, that you command a rapt and large audience. And I know people are very, very interested in hearing what you have to say. So thanks once again for coming to CSIS. We look forward to your remarks.
Thank you very much, Bass. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be able to come to Washington, D.C. again. The last time I was here was September last year, and I'm glad to be able to come back after almost half a year. I try to make myself a regular visitor, being a regular visitor to Washington, D.C. Every 4 months or so, so that I can come to Washington, D.C. About four times a year. But up until now, I was only able to fulfill that quota in the first year, and I try to catch up with that by visiting Washington, D.C. more often, provided that the American government would allow me to. I think Bass has already mentioned several important issues that Taiwan and the United States are facing across the Taiwan Strait. I think in the past few months, we see some developments in the cross-strait relations, and some are positive and some are negative, as being pointed out by Bates. And on the negative aspect, is probably something that many of us are very concerned about. The missile deployment is certainly one indicator, and the most updated statistics is that China has already deployed more than 1,000 short-range missiles targeted Taiwan. And other than the short-range missiles, I think the Chinese side also has cruise missiles, the whole array of cruise missiles and the intermediate range missiles, as well as submarine launched ballistic missiles. And they can be deployed against Taiwan at any time. And other than the missile threat, and I think people are also talking about the submarine buildup in China. According to some sources, China now has about 50 modern submarines, including those models that they built themselves and the Kilo class that they procured from Russia. And the military experts in the United States, like Eric continued to mention to Taiwan, that it takes only about 12 to 16 submarines to blockade Taiwan Strait. And China has more capability than they need to blockade Taiwan. So that is one issue. Both Taiwan and other countries that are concerned with the peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait region need to be concerned about. And other than these areas that we talk about very recently, I think the expansion of the Chinese military projection abilities is also something that we are concerned about. The military leaders in China continue to advocate a view that they need to have a naval power that can expand to the blue water in the Pacific Ocean. And I think what they think is exactly what they have been trying to do right now. And that is one issue that we have to look at very closely. And the most recent event in its anti-satellite capability demonstrated that China has a full intention to expand its military power, even try to militarize the use of space. And that is one issue Taiwan is very concerned about. And I think the reason is more than obvious. In the future conflict, if there's going to be one, between Taiwan and China, satellite is going to be used by the military, by the countries who are involved in the conflict. And if China can demonstrate that they can use that kind of a capability in destroying the satellites, and I think that is going to send a signal very clear to any country who is concerned about the future, possible future conflict in between Taiwan and China. And I think the Chinese choose the date in a very careful way when they do something important. And if you look at the date of the missile test to shoot down their satellites, that's January 11th of the January. I try to track down some of the main events around those days to see why the Chinese would choose that date to do that test. And I found two events that you might ponder upon whether these are the events that the Chinese have been targeted as the reason why they would do that test. The first event was Mr. Abe's visit to Europe. It was exactly on those few days. And when Abe toured Europe, the first issue that he mentioned to the European side is never lifting the arms embargo against China. And the Chinese got very angry. And the second event that I look around those days was the upgrade of the self-defense agency in Japan to the self-defense ministry. And that event also angered China. And the missile that the Chinese side used to shoot down the satellite is based upon TF-21, the intermediate range missiles. And of course, the Chinese side doesn't need intermediate range missiles against Taiwan because it takes longer time. The most effective ones will be those short range missiles, which take about 6 to 7 minutes to reach Taiwan. And the intermediate range missiles, it's got to be for someone else in that region. And therefore, I think what the Chinese side is sending signal to more than just Taiwan or the United States. I think it also has Japan in mind. And I think that leads to a situation where we need to consider a possible stronger alliance between the United States and Japan, and stronger and closer cooperation in security sense in between Taiwan and the United States in order to deal with the mounting problems in East Asia. And other than the military aspect, I think the diplomatic confrontation in between Taiwan and China is getting worse, much worse than before. Taiwan used to be able to participate in all kinds of non-governmental events. But right now, the Chinese side has been trying to either stopping Taiwan's participation or twist Taiwan's title of participation. And in last year alone, I recorded seven events, seven main events that the Chinese side have been attempted to change our title of participation. And I'll just give you one example. In February last year, there was a firefighters game held annually, which is being held annually. And Taiwan used to be able to participate with the title Taiwan. And what the Chinese side did last February was to force the organizer to change the title of Taiwan's participation from Taiwan into Taiwan, China. And of course, the firefighters in Taiwan couldn't accept that, and they negotiated with the organizer, but to no avail. So our firefighters had to withdraw from that game. So that is a very clear example of what the Chinese has attempted to do against Taiwan's international participation. And I think that kind of events just continue to go on. And of course, if the Chinese side continue to do that, the people in Taiwan will have their emotions. And sometimes I really feel that the diplomatic confrontation is probably more dangerous than the military exercises or verbal harassment against Taiwan. So this is something that we need to pay attention to. And if the Chinese side or the American government doesn't like Taiwan to think about its title change, and if the Chinese side continue to do that, I think it worth the attention of all the people here. And if there's any opportunity, I think we need to remind the Chinese side, if they don't like Taiwan to change their title, they shouldn't change Taiwan's title of international participation as well. So these are the more negative side in between Taiwan and China. And I would say that with this kind of background, what the government in Taiwan tried to do is to seek possibilities of reconciliation. And beginning from January 2005, there were opportunities for the two sides to sit down together to work something out on some practical issues. And what I referred to in January 2005 was the negotiation for the Lunar New Year charter flight. And I think that negotiation was quite successful. The demands from the two sides were drastically different because in the Chinese side, they don't recognize the legitimacy of the Taiwan government. So they have been asking that any kind of negotiation in between Taiwan and China has to be private negotiations or negotiations by the private organization. But when it comes to the aviation or tourism or any other government-related activities, there has to be participated by, you know, the negotiations have to be participated by the government officials. So the two sides came to the middle ground by agreeing with each other that private organizations can serve as a bridge point, and the officials between the two sides can then participate in the real negotiations. So the two sides work out that kind of differences, and that is what we call the Macau model. And after the negotiation in January 2005, Taiwan side continued to approach the Chinese side for more negotiations on the charter flight issue. And there were a major announcement in June last year that there will be four packages of charter flight. But of course, we don't think that those four packages of charter flight, especially those charter flight on the four major festivals, will be enough to make transportation linkages in between the two sides more convenient. So what we have been trying to do after that was to continue to approach the Chinese side for more negotiations on more charter flights, either on the cargo charter flights or passenger charter flights. And I hope that there can be more breakthroughs in the near future so that the transportation linkages in between the two sides can be made more convenient. And in the earlier negotiations of the charter flights, the qualification of the passenger has always been that Taiwanese can take those, but not anyone else. And what we try to do at this moment is to be more inclusive. We try to allow the Chinese side to be able to take advantage of the charter flight and try to allow the internationals to take advantage of the charter flight as well. And I'm sure if there's going to be a major breakthrough in the near future, the American businessmen operating in Taiwan or China will be thrilled by that kind of breakthrough. And I think the negotiation for tourism is also something that I personally worked very hard on. And I think we are coming to the final phase of the negotiations with each other, and the two sides may be able to strike an agreement very soon. I don't know how soon that will be, but it will depends on the speed of the pace of the negotiation in between the two sides. But I personally hope that that can be done very shortly. And the reason why I personally wanted want many visitors from China to visit Taiwan is the reason is quite obvious. You know, the Chinese government continue to apply very restricted propaganda rules on the Chinese media, and therefore the average Chinese do not have a very good chance to understand Taiwan in an accurate way. And I think the best way to allow the Chinese to understand about Taiwan is to bring them to Taiwan and to see for their own eyes what Taiwan is like. And this is what I have in mind. And if there can be a steady flow of the Chinese to visit Taiwan, and I think in the long run, the cross-strait relations will improve based upon better mutual understanding and gradually build up mutual trust. And of course, there are other issue areas that the Taiwan government is very interested in bringing the Chinese side to the negotiation table, because there are so many issues because of the close connections in between the two sides in business areas, that there are many issues that the two sides will have an interest in working out. And we will continue to work in that area to make sure that the cross-strait relations is a peaceful one, and it's a stable one. And I don't know whether that is a wishful thinking or not, but I'll continue to work along that direction. But I think the political events in both China and Taiwan is probably not going to allow us to be very optimistic about the cross-strait relations, especially after the summer. And the reason is because there's political events in China and there's political events in Taiwan. On the Taiwan side, we have a legislative election at the end of the year, and then we have a presidential election next March. And on the Chinese side, I think they are going through a succession cycle toward for this year. So the two events might make the two, both Taiwan and China, too occupied by domestic affairs. And I think the situation will not allow the two sides to pursue more negotiations. So what we try to do in Taiwan is that before the political events take over domestically in Taiwan or in China, we try to work as hard as we can to make sure that the two sides have opportunities for breakthrough. And I think I'll stop here because I'm sure you have plenty of questions to ask me, and I'll try to answer to the best as I can.
Thank you very much, Joseph. We do appreciate your laying out several of the key issues you're working on right now, and also to give us some of your thinking about the prospects for improvement going forward. If I may, I just wanted to touch on several issues that you didn't have a chance to address. I presume many of them are on the minds of our audience, and I'll just preempt them a little bit and bring them up and get your thoughts on them. I mean, as you're well aware, there are a range of concerns here in the United States about certain developments in Taiwan and how it might affect stability or security across the Taiwan Strait. And I'll just name several of them, and I'd be interested if you wanted to respond to one or two or just give us a little bit more context for us to understand current developments. For example, we know that there is already a lot of talk about various referenda that might, in one way or another, accompany the 2008 presidential election. Critics would argue this is an effort on the part of the DPP particularly to inspire a greater turnout, for example, but might actually result in a popular decision in Taiwan that could, depending on the referenda, be seen as provocative by Beijing. Discussions we hear increasingly of the notion of a second republic constitution is one that many persons are concerned about here in Washington, and be interested to hear what you have to say about that. We've also heard most recently some talk of possibly applying to the United Nations under the name of Taiwan rather than the Republic of China. I personally don't think it's going to make any difference what name you choose, but nevertheless, this has political ramifications as well. We're hearing as well that there may be some reconsideration or some rethinking being done in Taiwan about the possible, not only the large arms package that everyone has been sort of waiting for to see passage, but even on the question of renewed F-16 sales to Taiwan. This might be another bone of contention in U.S.-Taiwan relations going forward. And if it's a little bit off of your portfolio, but if you just want to pick one or two of those questions, I think our audience would be very interested to hear and how you intend to address these questions and sort of reassure people about them.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this set of very difficult issues for me to answer, even though I'm not directly in charge of these kinds of things. But I do have a little knowledge about the referendum or about the constitutional reform or about the procurement of the defensive articles. I think on the referendum, there have been discussions about what kind of issues that we can do either together with the legislative election or the presidential election. And so far, I think the only drive that has been picking up steam is the referendum on the party assets, the KMT party assets. And that is probably going to be the one on the ballot together with the legislative election at the end of the year. But as to the UN issue, I don't know whether that is going to gather sufficient signatures in order to become valid and in order to become an issue to be voted on together with the presidential election or the legislative election. But some people within the DPP, in particular Mr. Chong Tai, I think some of you have known him quite well, and he's been working on this issue, but we still don't know whether he's able to be successful in getting enough signatures. But I think this one thing I must point out on the issue of constitution reform. As a result of the constitution reform of 2005, I think the constitution procedures of changing the constitution has been set. You know, if there's going to be any constitution revision, it has to pass the three-quarters majority of the legislative yuan. And then it will go on to be voted on by the people in a referendum. So, you know, if there's going to be any resolution passed by the legislative, then it will have to be voted on by the people to go through the constitution process. But any kind of constitution reform to gather three-quarter majority in the legislative is certainly going to be very difficult. And if we are going to have a three-quarter majority support of any constitution reform bill, I think those kinds of bills are going to be quite moderate in nature. And there's another issue that I would like to bring to your attention. That is related to the passage of the procurement bill. If you look at the performance of the legislative yuan, I think you will get the same kind of impression like the regular Taiwanese people. And we think that the constitution system we have in Taiwan is not contributing to the kind of politics that we need for Taiwan facing a very strong challenge from China. The kind of political system we have in Taiwan is contributing to more and more political conflict rather than bringing compromise and reconciliation. And I think we need to think about a new type of political system that will bring about compromise and reconciliation. And many intellectuals within the DPP or within the academic circle has been thinking about a parliamentary type of political system. And I think that kind of political system is getting more support among the Taiwan public. And if that kind of a new model of the constitution is adopted by the legislative yuan, and I think it has to go through a referendum, of course, in order to become part of our constitution. But on the Second Republic or any other variation or any other discussion of the constitution, I think they are all in the process right now. And within a month or two, we will see the discussions on various forms of constitution to surface up in Taiwan politics so that people in Taiwan have opportunities to discuss the merits of different political systems to be used in Taiwan. And I would say, again, that if it requires a three-quarter majority to pass any motion in the legislative and concerning our constitution reform, and I think those kinds of motions will be very moderate in nature. And I think arms procurement bill is something that you're concerned about, and you know, Taiwan government is very concerned about as well. But there was some progress on this issue in the past couple of months or so. Remember that the KMT, the Pan Blue side, has been trying to stop it from going through the procedural committee, and they stopped it for 70 times. But after 70 times, it went through the procedural committee. And the package for the new year, new fiscal year, is being discussed and approved by the Defense Committee. And among the packages approved in the Defense Committee would include the procurement for 12 P-3C anti-submarine airplanes and the budget for the PAC-2 Plus upgrade and the assessment fee for the submarine procurement. So it's moving somewhere, and it's pending the floor decision of the legislative yuan. But when it comes to the vote on the government budget at the end of the last session, you probably saw it from the CNN that there was a bitter fight, a fiscal fight, on the floor, and it prevented the government budget from going through. It's not just the arms budget, but also the budget for the Mainland Affairs Council and budget for all government institutions in Taiwan. And we hope that in the new session of the legislative yuan beginning in early March, there will be opportunities for the government budget, including the arms procurement budget, to be approved by the legislative yuan. And that is the newest development. And of course, if you look at the Mainland Affairs Council budget, you know, our budget has been frozen last year, and it's not defrozen yet. And there might be more problems for our budget. And you can see that there's really a need to create a new constitution system that will improve the government efficiency and the government good governance.
Thanks very much for all of those great answers, great responses, Joseph. I'm sure it's only sparked more interest for people to ping you with some questions. So if you just let me see you, if you're interested in raising an issue, and I'll try to get you on a list. Well, Tom, please identify yourself also to Joseph in case he doesn't know you.
Thank you. I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council. How do you think the 2008 Olympics in Beijing will affect the relations between China and Taiwan? Among other issues, is Taiwan going to be sending a team to participate, and under what name will it participate?
Well, thank you very much for that question. Taiwan has been participating in Summer Olympics all along for more than 20 years, and I think there shouldn't be any exception for the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing. The title that we will use, even though we don't like that title, but that is the compromise we reached with the International Olympic Committee, that we will use the Chinese Taipei as our title in participation. And of course, we will not be able to use our national flag. We will use a very strange flag that we call the Olympic flag, Taiwan Olympic flag. And if there happens to be Taiwan athletes that win a gold medal, and we won't be able to play Taiwan national anthem. We will play a Taiwan national flag anthem. So that is the agreement for Taiwan to be able to participate in Summer Olympics, and I think this will be the same arrangement in 2008. But what we are concerned about nowadays about the Summer Olympics, other than the air pollution, very bad air pollution in Beijing area, is that the Chinese side always attempt to twist our participation whenever they can. It is going to be held in Beijing, and I think Chinese won't let that kind of good opportunity go in twisting our participation. They'll probably put us together with the Hong Kong and Macau athletes to signify that Taiwan is part of them. And this another thing that they might manipulate is, offer to Taiwan that the Olympic torch is going to pass through Taiwan, you know, coming from Hong Kong and going back to Hong Kong to signify that Taiwan is part of China. So they might do that. And, of course, there's a natural tendency for Taiwan to resist the Chinese pressure in that regard. And I think in the Summer Olympics, you will be able to see Taiwan team participating in the game in a normal fashion.
In the green spot. Sure. Why don't you?
Okay. Thanks. Wu Zhiwei, 你好，欢迎到华盛顿。My name is Ge Yu. I'm from Georgetown University. This morning, a lot of Taiwanese paper reported that the chairman Yu Chi-kun is going to propose to withdraw the guards from the Cihu burial place, which is where Chiang Kai-shek was buried. This has been seen as a step in the rectification campaign launched by Taiwanese government since 2002, which is aimed to change every Taiwanese national symbol from referring to China as referring to Taiwan. And for many years, both sides of the Taiwan Strait has been blaming each other for changing the status quo. For Taiwan, it sees the status quo as Taiwan is already an independent country, which we heard a lot of times recently from Li Tenghui. My question is, if Taiwan already sees itself as an independent country, why is the rectification campaign still necessary? Isn't the Taiwanese government self-contradictory? On one hand, it says it's independent. On the other hand, it sees so many national symbols that has to be changed to fit into an independent country. Isn't that changing the status quo? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that question. I think the comment made by Chairman Yu has his own intention for the domestic purpose. But I think what he said may gather support in Taiwan. And the reason is not to do with name ratification, but the reason is to do with the way Taiwan deal with the remnants of past authoritarianism. Chiang Kai-shek used to be hated by many Taiwanese, and he was a ruthless leader in Taiwan in dealing with the domestic opposition. So in the minds of the DPP, which is the key opposition when the KMT was still in power, Chiang Kai-shek was not the one that can be cherished by the DPP at the time. And therefore, there's a natural tendency to deal with Chiang Kai-shek after Taiwan has been democratized. And I think if you look at the name change of Chiang Kai-shek Airport, from Chiang Kai-shek Airport into Taoyuan Airport, is certainly one of those efforts. And I think if you look at Taiwan, the Chiang Kai-shek statues are being removed from every corner. This is just Chiang Kai-shek statues, but there are more and more statues being removed. And I think that's a natural process of Taiwan's democratization. You know, Taiwan is a democracy, and when we look at the past authoritarian leader, we don't think that he or she is the one that should be cherished or should be supported or should be remembered as a great leader anymore. So that is what happened to the proposition to remove the guards from Cihu. And I don't think it has to do with the name ratification, that sort of thing. But about the name ratification issue, or the what we say, 证明, I think it also relates to the dealing with the past authoritarianism. If you look at Taiwan's national flag, actually, the key components of that flag is the KMT symbol. So when we look at that flag, we understand that is the product of the past party-state structure. But it becomes very difficult for Taiwan to change the national flag because the international community has attached such important sovereignty connotation to the national flag. And that is the reason why President Chen had to say that as long as China doesn't have any intention to use force against Taiwan, we will not change our national flag. You know, that kind of a commitment. And I don't think that the remaining term of the president is going to have any possibility or have any intention to change our national flag. And I think national anthem is also another remnant of past authoritarianism, and it's more obvious than the national flag issue, because the national anthem is the KMT anthem. It's exactly the same one. And of course, Taiwan is already a democracy. You know, people, there's a natural tendency for people not to think that the KMT anthem is a legitimate one for a democratic Taiwan. So I think the discussion along that area is a very natural one for a democracy. So it's a health expression of a young democracy. But for the change of national title, the ultimate one of the name ratification, we can also find justification in it. I don't know whether you pick up a story which happened in Grenada just a couple of days ago, that Grenada switched its diplomatic recognition to China a couple of years ago in 2005, and they helped to build a gymnasium, and there was a bunch of Chinese dignitaries visited the country to celebrate the completion of that building. Then the Grenadian government started to play the national anthem, but it happens to be Taiwan's anthem rather than the Chinese anthem. And that embarrassed and angered the Chinese side. And you can see how confusing Taiwan's national title is. You know, it not only confused us, but also confused other countries as well. I remember that there was an event held in Canada, I think it was 2005 as well. You know, the conference was about the watchdog bodies of various countries to have an annual conference. And Taiwan has a control yuan. And therefore, Taiwan's control yuan is still legitimately represented in that conference. And China doesn't have a watchdog body, so they don't have any representation. And in 2005, the host organizer was so thrilled that they saw the name from Republic of China. So they raised the flag to celebrate, you know, along with other countries, to celebrate that, you know, there's a participation from the Republic of China. But the flag they had up was the Chinese flag rather than Taiwan's flag. So you can see that this kind of thing is getting very confusing. So, you know, people have a natural tendency to see whether there's any way to make a little clarification. And I think the earlier attempt in the middle of last year by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to include Taiwan after our national title is exactly that kind of attempt to show other people that this Republic of China is not actually China, it's Taiwan. So this is what we see in the name ratification thing.
Thank you, Joseph. Please, let me go over here. Thank you.
Hi, Joseph. In spite of the cold outside...
Could you identify yourself, everyone, here?
Gerrit van der Wies of the Formosan Association for Public Affairs. In spite of the cold outside, you're warmly welcome here in Washington, D.C. Last week at the hearing of the U.S.-China Review Commission, there was quite an important testimony by writer Jim Mann, who testified that the scenario that China's growth will lead to political liberalization, on which both the U.S. and the Taiwan policies are based, is way too optimistic. And he said it's much more likely that China will become economically very powerful, but for a long time to come remain a very authoritarian system. What implications would this have for Taiwan's policies?
Well, I think about the possible liberalization or even democratization in China is certainly something that we pay very close attention to. The current misunderstanding or mistrust in between the two sides stem from the institutional differences. You know, Taiwan is a democracy, and everything is done in a transparent way. But in China, things are done in a different fashion. And therefore, you know, there's a lot of people who are hoping that once China becomes more transparent, China becomes more democratic, Chinese people have more freedom, then there's a possibility for the two sides to work out their differences. And after all, you know, the democracy serves the same kind of a belief system. So that was what we hope for. And even though there are indications that under President Hu Jintao, the Chinese control of the mass media or control of the population is getting tighter than before. Sometime last year, I also committed, maybe you know, September last year when I was here, I commented that the Chinese control is tighter than in the, what we saw in the past 20 years or so. We see more journalists sent to jail. We saw more books banned. We saw more newspapers banned. And we saw more human rights lawyers being jailed or being beaten up, and some even involved with international journalists like the Singapore Straits Times journalist or the New York Times journalist. So these kinds of things is happening. But in the past few months, we also saw conflicting indicators in China. You know, for example, there's a book published by Yu Keping, and for those who know China very well, Yu Keping is one of those close associate of President Hu Jintao. And he gave an interview, and that interview became a book called Democracy is a Good Stuff, 民主是个好东西. And the preface of that book, which is very good, has been widely cited in China. And even one newspaper in Beijing has been reprinted that article. And I would say that's probably one indicator that there might be possible liberalization, even though I'm not overly optimistic about this. And another indication is that the Chinese government has announced that during the period of Olympic Summer Olympics in 2008, that they will liberalize the rules on the international media covering the event. And the period begins from January 1st this year. And we do see some international journalists interviewing some dissidents, and they get printed. So these might become another indicator of possible liberalization of China in the near future. And, you know, based upon our experience in the 1970s and 80s, we saw that when the authoritarian leader, allow a little room for the opposition to play, they will never close it down anymore. And I think what the opposition in China or dissidents in China will want is to continue to expand the rooms of their freedom. And that is what we hope for. And that is exactly the topic Taiwan and the United States can work very closely with each other so that we can guarantee that the process of transformation or liberalization in China is a peaceful one. And what we try to do in Taiwan is to, you know, open us up to allow anyone who wants to visit Taiwan to be able to visit Taiwan, to let them understand how democracy functions. And I think there's a distinction in between, the Chinese visitors in the United States and the Chinese visitors in Taiwan. There's language barrier for those Chinese who visited China, who visited the United States, but there is no language barrier for those visitors to visit Taiwan. You know, when they are in Taiwan, they can talk to regular people, they can read newspapers, they can watch televisions, and I think they can get a much better sense in Taiwan of how democracy functions than in other countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wu. Welcome to D.C.
Thank you.
My name is Chad Novacek, and I'm a graduate student at SAIS. One question for you. We read in the media, for the most part, that the Chinese Civil War has been over for some time. Some accounts state the opposite. But from your perspective or from the top leadership in Taiwan, what would you say would be the time that the Chinese Civil War had ended and also under what conditions? Thank you.
Well, there are different interpretations on this question. If you look at the actual military activities in between Taiwan and China, the main part has come to a stop in 1949 when the nationalist government fled to Taiwan. And even though there were sporadic crises in between the two sides afterward, but basically there was a general truce in between Taiwan and China after 1949. So many people describe that the civil war should end at that time. But Taiwan continue to live under the nationalist government's authoritarian rule up until early 1990s. And I think many people in Taiwan are trying to describe that the civil war actually came to an end only in 1991, when President Li Denghui announced the end of the emergency period against the communist rebellion. And at that time, what the nationalist government tried to do was to announce that Taiwan will pursue a normal relations with China. And that is probably another way to look at it, because prior to that, the KMT's official ideology is continue to try to move back to mainland China by taking over China. They want to destroy the Chinese communist bandits, in the old jargons used by the old authoritarian leaders at the time. But I think we still have another angle to look at this. Because even after 1991, the Constitution and many other institutions and legal establishment in Taiwan still described that the two sides hasn't formally ended the conflict yet. If you look at the cross-strait law, the law provides the legal foundation for the Mainland Affairs Council. It says very clear that on the one hand, there's a freedom area. And on the other hand, there's a mainland area. And as you can see from those terms, you know that maybe the civil war hasn't ended. So I think that if we want the civil war to be formally ended, I think we need to look at all the legal establishment in Taiwan to make sure that there's no that kind of languages to discriminate against China. And I think at the same time, we need to look at all the legal frameworks in China to make sure that there's no more belligerent clauses against Taiwan.
Thank you, Joseph. I'm cognizant of the time, and there are at least three more people that I've recognized thus far, and I want to ask all three of them to get their questions out, okay? And then, Joseph, you can respond, and we'll see where we stand in terms of our time. So this gentleman here has been very patient, and these two gentlemen here at the end have also sought recognition, so please.
Wei Yanchen, Formosa Association for Public Affairs. The other day, there was a seminar on the free trade, and it seems to me that the American business community is very interested in these three things. Can you give us some update of this issue and what are stumbling blocks between two sides?
Eric McVaden, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Joseph, you mentioned the large number of ballistic missiles and the addition of cruise missiles and the submarines. And so I would modify that point from my viewpoint. There are probably about two dozen really modern submarines, but still when you mix the old ones with the new ones, it's a very daunting proposition. You mentioned the anti-satellite thing too. Yet I hear from some of my PLA contacts that there is a recognition that an increased threat, that this buildup is counterproductive. It's alienating people in Taiwan and so forth. Are you seeing any evidence whatsoever of something concrete happening with respect to that being more than words about the counterproductive aspect of a continuing buildup?
Well, I may have to use my lecturer's voice. Then, Mr. Wu, there has long been. I'm sorry, Howard Wiarda from CSIS. There has long been a very large reservoir of goodwill toward Taiwan in this country, and I have the impression that over the last 20 years that has shrunk somewhat. And I wonder if you might talk about that a little bit. Is that due to the People's Republic becoming more effective globally? Is it due to Taiwan becoming less effective in its public relations effort? Is it due to American and other restrictions on some of your activities? Could you talk about this a little bit, please?
Right, thanks very much. Three tough questions on three links and views of the PLA and your take on current U.S.-Taiwan relations.
Well, thank you for all three questions. On the first one, the FTA is something that we want from the United States. You know, if you look at the economic relations between Taiwan and China, what we see is that Taiwan is getting more and more dependent on China. And at the same time, the Chinese hostility toward Taiwan has not ended. And the Chinese hostility may be building up more because of their military buildup. And therefore, we hope that an FTA with the United States would prevent Taiwan from being, sucking into the Chinese economic orbit in order for Taiwan to maintain its autonomy. And I think the both American business community in Taiwan and the American government has been saying that Shantung, or the three direct linkages, is a key to the FTA. But the difficulty for Taiwan in negotiating with China on the three direct linkages or the direct air flights in between the two sides is that the Chinese government simply doesn't want to negotiate with Taiwan. So that is the most difficult thing. And we understand that kind of difficulty, and that is the reason why we want to pursue more charter flights as an intermediate step toward eventual direct flight in between the two sides. And the reason is because, since the reason for not having the direct flight is because the Chinese side doesn't want to negotiate with Taiwan. So I think the better approach, rather than criticizing Taiwan, is to urge the Chinese side to look at this issue as an important issue and start negotiating with Taiwan without preconditions. Okay, and the second one, the military buildup and the intimidation and the diplomatic harassment, all these kinds of things, is really counterproductive. I still remember very well that the key phrase of Mr. Hu Jintao in dealing with Taiwan after he assumed his top leadership position by becoming the chairman of the Central Military Commission is that they have three whatevers, Whatever is good for the Taiwan people, they will try to do it and try to make it successful. And I think what they showed to Taiwan by extending goodwills to Taiwan is okay. But the diplomatic harassment or military buildup or the asset test is certainly very counterproductive. And if you look at the public opinion reactions, certainly we don't see people moving closer to China because of the negotiations or because of the closer economic linkages. And that is something for the Chinese leaders to ponder upon. And I don't think that the military solution or the military harassment or diplomatic harassment against Taiwan is the right way to deal with the cross-strait relations. And the third question, I think it's very important for us, and the key foreign policy establishment in Taiwan has been pondering upon this issue all the time, and we've been asking ourselves why we are encountering more difficulties in either dealing with the administration or dealing with the Capitol Hill. Where is the problem? Is it us, or is it China, or is it because of the United States? And I think, we find reasons in, three countries. In Taiwan, since it's become a democracy, what would you expect when the administration in the United States that recognized that Taiwan is a democracy, Taiwan is a model for China to emulate, we would expect that the United States would render full support for Taiwan, no matter what Taiwan does, if Taiwan is going through this kind of a democratic process. But that is not what we see. And therefore, there was a misunderstanding created because of that. And on the Chinese side, I think they've become more powerful in terms of their diplomatic activities or in terms of their economic influence, and especially economic influence. We saw that they might be able to influence more congressmen by the economic incentives than before. And that is the area that Taiwan is probably not able to as before. So that is one area that we saw that China has becoming different from before. And they're also learning from Taiwan. And we used to be a very successful lobbyist on the Capitol Hill. And the Chinese side has been learning every skill from Taiwan, except that they spend more money. They have more people working on the same thing. And therefore, you can see that it's becoming more difficult for us. And during the recent period of time, what we see in the United States is that there's a lot of discussion about Iraq. There's a lot of discussion about the six-party talks and the Korean Peninsula crisis. But there's very little conversations or very little discussions about the cross-strait issues. And some people even describe that Taiwan simply fall off the radar screen. And therefore, the attention the administration will pay to Taiwan because of the crisis in different places is getting much less than before now. And I think that's also the reason why we would encounter more difficulties or, you know, getting less goodwills, from this end. So these are primarily the reasons that we have encountered.
Well, Joseph, I'm very sorry we've only had an hour with you. I think we could go on for another hour or two. Your responses are always eloquent, direct, frank. You don't shy away from very difficult questions, and we really appreciate how straightforward you've been and willing to take on a lot of tough issues and give some forthright responses. We welcome you to be back with us again. Of course, we look forward to meeting you when we can in Taipei, and I hope everyone will join me in giving a very strong round of applause and thanking Dr. Wu for being with us today.